heart. So, guess what? You're listening to the Lean Into Artcast, a show where two visual storytellers, visual communicators, get together and take a walk, a mental perambulation around a couple topics, usually a few tiny topics, and then one big topic where we start 1,000 feet up and then zoom in on the ground with some practical thoughts, tips, and possibly even a stupid healthy tip. My name is Jersey Drozd, and that other guy is...
I'm Rob Stenzinger. Hey.
Hey.
Hey, get off my lawn. or hey, hang out if you're into talking about, getting analytical about creative endeavors and whatnot.
Just to tease the topic, this week's topic is self-learning skill set, research. We're going to talk about research, which sounds like a dry topic, but I get excited about this topic. I don't know about you, Rob.
Oof, I live it. I breathe it.
I'm learning to love research. But before we do that, we got to start with the curveball or, the difficult topic, the mental warm-up exercise, which you proposed this week. I don't have a curveball for you. We're just going to give the whole 10 minutes over to your curveball because I think that there's enough meat in there. There's probably enough meat for like a 40-minute conversation about it. But let's just see what we can do with 10. What do you say?
Sounds awesome. So should I bounce this ball aggressively off the wall at myself?
Yes.
Okay.
Frame it up. Okay. Start bouncing around. I'll jump in when I can catch it.
All right. Awesome. Because I may need to be saved with this. It's a very very dense racquetball that's tough to see in the dark. And for some reason, I'm throwing in the dark. All right. So. I noticed something the other day. Like, this is one of those experiences, kind of like what you mentioned, Jersey, when you're watching some entertainment or reading something or whatever, and then then all of a sudden I had this visceral reaction to what I was listening to, and it was kind of opposite from the earlier visceral reaction where, okay, so I picked up the let me look at what the album is, but it was a Five Finger Death Punch, The Way of the Fist, which so sounds like an album that I would like the heck out of. And anyway, because I heard the song The Bleeding when I was on Spotify, and I just couldn't stop, doing the headbanging motion. I'm like, this is wonderful. I want a whole album of this. And as I started going through it, they provide very skilled, wonderful, tasty metal riffs and drum beats that I was just really, really digging. And then I started noticing, because they ebb and flow back and forth between two singing styles. Like they do the and they also do the la la la. They do, the growling and the crooning. And I started picking up on the messages and the lyrics through the crooning, and all of a sudden that kind of shocked me out of the same level of enjoyment I was having, because it just represented a really different worldview than I don't feel like I share, at least at this point in my life. And I was like, kind of cringing after a bit, and I started wondering, like, well, why would that matter, right? Because I mean, I listen to Slayer too, right? And is it because I can't tell what they're saying that I'm not always, having a bad reaction to? I'm just into the overall feeling of it. And anyway, then I started to wonder, like, what's the I had this connection where I went, wait a minute, there was a time where I did listen to more music like this. The song The Bleeding, I'm sorry, I'm not throwing a good curveball here and I'm wandering around a bit, so by all means, tackle me, but
you're throwing it at the dirt and then you're picking it up and you're running to first base and you're running back to the pitcher's mound throwing it at the
totally.
Dirt
again, and then like I throw it in the crowd. Duck. He's going,
what do you mean you can't hit it, Jersey?
Yeah. Clearly, the man needs more sleep. So, which actually isn't true today. But let's see. So it reminded me a little bit of this. I'll get more specific. So the lyrics in the Bleeding, it's talking about like a failed relationship thing, and that's like a good emotional fertile ground. Everyone's had ups and downs with relationships of some sort, right? And it's pretty neutral because of that. It's such a common experience. But then it the other songs were kind of a grumpy, unempowered view of things. Like, why is this all happening to me? Grump, grump, grump. It's happening to me. It's happening. It's just, well, where I'm thinking, well, you have such a strong, powerful voice, actor, in this song. Why aren't you doing something else about this matter?
Was it like a pride of victimhood thing?
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought, oh, and so I was having this frustrated dialogue with myself where, you know, I was like both arguing for and against it at the same time, but having this conflict where, okay, they clearly are reaching me emotionally. What a great thing to do with your art, right? Yet, intellectually, all of a sudden, I'm getting shaken a bit in a way that's dissonant with this other feeling. And then I thought, I was stuck there for a while. And then I thought, why am I stuck here? And I thought, you know what? They have done something pretty incredible to get me to do this. And I thought, that's impressive. In a work of art to be able to do that. And I thought, now I'm envious a bit, where I'm like, you know what? I want to be able to do that as well, to cause that kind of, maybe not in the same way, right? And I don't know if I, you know, would want to try in the same way they're approaching the
whole
thing.
Or better or worse, they got you thinking about their music all the time.
They did. And so, yeah, I left it with like more of a feeling of respect, and saying, well, there's probably more here to think about. And thinking like, you know what? I bet there is a character here or something for a story.
Oh, yeah. For certain. I want to dig at this just a little bit.
Cool.
Hope I don't sound too much like a shrink here. Was it that you felt that they were trying to sell you on their position? Was it propaganda, or was it just you can't – that you have, for whatever reason, a disdain for somebody who just openly weeps about their victimhood?
It was let's see. Gosh, that's really hard to answer, honestly. I mean, I think it's a
you've been curveballed.
I have. You did it. Wow. You picked it up and you're like, okay, here's how you do it. Phew.
No,
I just watched it sail by. I'm like, whoa.
No. No, that's when you know you're properly in the curveball zone is when you go.
Yeah. Well, that was a good one. It's I think I have some complicated feelings on the matter regarding someone with such a strong, powerful voice, yet not able to see some other alternatives that they could channel that frustration to, instead of elevating their victimhood, elevate what they could be doing, right?
Okay, I want to back up a little bit and just go to the Pat last 5 minutes of the episode of Growing Pains or Brady Bunch or whatever show you're watching. And cool. Say that, you know, what most people are going to say is, well, are you going to enjoy it for the craft, or are you going to enjoy it because of what they mean to you as a person? Are you going to enjoy it for the message? You know, like, for instance, I've gone through bouts where I just can't listen to any music with lyrics that I can understand. You know, like, I'll listen to like German pop music or something because I don't know what they're saying. They could be saying terrible things, but I don't care because I just get to focus on the music. I'm not distracted by anybody trying to sell me on how smart they are or how cool they are and that nonsense. But, you know, but the end of the sitcom episode, they're going to say, well, pick your one thing and enjoy it for that. And if you don't like that other part, either choose to not listen anymore or just choose to ignore that part of it, kind of thing. But then zooming in a little bit, is that I think an interesting thing to point out here is that you said it's complicated. You don't know if it's an issue where they're trying to sell you an agenda or a bill of goods and you're responding to that, or if this is something where perhaps you have a hang up about this particular thing. This is a hot button issue with you. I don't say hang up to mean like you're neurotic. I just mean like it's a hot button issue. It's something that gets you fired up because it's a topic that you feel passionately against, right? So yeah. You know, we've gone into these topics in the past, things that, you know, what is the one way to get kicked out of the Rob Stenzinger tribe? What's the one way to get kicked out of the Jersey Joe's tribe, right? What's the one cardinal sin? It could be something like that. And that's worth responding to, I think, properly the way you've done it, by saying, like, there's a character here. Because cognitive dissonance is something that we all experience, where something's complicated, we're not sure why we're responding so viscerally to it. And it's interesting that you are responding with respect to the thing being expertly done, but what they're saying is the antithesis of what you believe, right?
Basically,
But they're doing a magnificent job of it.
And they are, yeah. And I can't tell why they're doing it. That's the other thing where, like, is it a character for them? And if they did, like they invented the a really good character to push some buttons on me.
Yeah, yeah. I was just reading was it New York Times or was it a Forbes article? I don't remember. I was getting it through Flipboard, so it was some article that somebody forwarded on or somebody, you know, blogged about.
Which is exactly why they have a problem with Flipboard.
Yeah. You know, what I should have done – well, see, it was an article that kind of pushed my buttons. And so it was one of those ones where I got about halfway through and I was like, I'm responding to this emotionally. Am I responding emotionally because they're making a really strong case for something I disagree with? Or am I responding emotionally because I'm hung up on something, you know? And so I just shut it off. I just closed it. You know, I'm not reading any more of this. I think I'm just responding because I got a hang up and this guy's just annoying me. He's not making a strong case for something. I feel like to use some language you just used, he's putting on a character to make an interesting article, which is a form of entertainment, but it's a cupcake form of entertainment to me personally, right? Mm-hmm. I want more, you know, meat in there somehow. I want something that if I'm going to give you 5 minutes of my time, you better make me think hard about something, right? Or delight me. One of the two. And if you're not doing both, I'm walking out. But you know, but then somebody's gonna say, well, geez, you know, Rob, you know, just because you don't agree with them doesn't mean they're not good. But that's what you said. You know, you said that they're doing a magnificent job of disagreeing with something that you feel very strongly about, and that is a complicated bag. Just before we started recording, I brought up Morrison Con, Grant Morrison's convention. It's at morrisoncon.com. You should
because you're preparing for the announcement of JerseyCon, right?
Oh, right. Jeepers, crackers. Yes. No, you know, and I feel like I can critique this because, A, I don't have any aspirations of being considered on the same playing field. And B, it's not like I'm hunting for this guy to be a guest and comics are great. And C, I have nothing but crazy respect for the man's work, but I have no problem saying that, you know, a con, where you take your last name, put the word con after it, is pretty much the antithesis of how I feel about comics, right? It's like, so I've told the story before. Every time I get ready to go out and do Comics Are Great on Wednesdays at the Ann Arbor District Library, you know, Ann likes to poke fun at me. And she's like, oh, you gonna go do the Jersey Show today? She sings this little song, the Jersey Show, the Jersey Show, because she knows it pushes my buttons. Because she knows that's something I feel really strongly about. That it's not about me, it's about comics, you know? So then when somebody comes along and says, hey, it's the insert my last name con, I'm a celebrity, would you like to pay for the privilege of hanging out with me? Not that that's what Morrison Con is necessarily saying. Although,
quick question. I mean, just the devil's advocate, is he doing some kind of intense, like, way of the Morrison workshop thing? Or is it truly just watch a Morrison, not in his natural habitat, sign things? You know, anyway.
Okay. It looks like there's some kind of programming in here.
Okay.
Grant Morrison, the future of the third millennium. Grant Morrison is dreaming about the world of the future again, and he is not alone. Join Grant on a transcendental journey into the future of all things Morrison, starting with an in-depth expose and look into what awaits us in the pages of 2012's most anticipated new creator-owned series, Happy, with Derek Robertson. So it's looking like Comic-Con kind of stuff. Panels, music.
So
Thugloid
it's...
Thugloid Heroes, comics, love affair with Hollywood. Oy.
The Grant Morrison... Grant Morrison and the Grant Morrison Experience posse thing.
Kind of. And so this is the thing. It's I don't want to turn this into a let's bash Grant Morrison thing, because I don't want
to
bash the
guy.
No,
I'm trying to play with the idea and whatnot. And yeah, and I do think I have to assume there must be more to it, right? There's got to be something.
Well, it looks like it's a pretty mixed bag of entertainment style stuff, discussion style stuff, programming style stuff. Okay. But and you know, see, this is that cognitive dissonance that I wanted to use as an example, is that it really isn't about bashing the guy. I'm saying that I'm not faulting the guy for trying to get his hustle on, and I'm certainly not faulting him for leveraging his celebrity, because there's a reason he's a celebrity, right? What I recoil from is the concept of celebrity in the traditional way people think about it. So this reeks enough of that to make me go, ooh, and then I go, but he's mobilizing people, he's making things happen, that's to be respected, right? That's awesome, that's good for him. But on the other hand, I'm like, oh, but the way he's doing it just rubs me all sorts of wrong ways. You know, so anyway, it's
cool that it's not black and white, right? I mean, there you go. I mean, we don't have to represent allow me to tag in on the growing pains lesson, and we don't have to represent one side of a black and white argument, and we just yell at each other from across a silly imaginary line.
You Buddhist. No, but see, this is what I was going to joke around about early on when you were telling me your story. It was like, you know what your problem is, Rob? You see both sides of things. Stop it. You'll lead a happier life.
Yeah. Some days I think I would, but, I'd probably have to choose a different career path.
Well, that was almost 15 minutes. So not to be all persnickety about time, I just wanted to let you know that I think we kind of walked around that one a little bit. If anybody, here's what we can do with these warm-up exercises and curveballs. If anybody wants to hear more on this topic, let us know. leanintoart@gmail.com. Tag, you know, send us a @tweet on Twitter and say, hey, that thing you guys mentioned on the show, like for instance, Stephen McCraney, who at former comics are great guest, malinchad.com, messaged me to say that he just watched the episode, the five ways to think about Saturday morning cartoons to improve your writing episode we did. I think it was episode 31 or something like that. And he said that at the end of the episode, I mentioned that I would be happy to do an episode on Kid Logic. And he said, boy, I'd love to see that. So there you go. So that's
what it was. Awesome.
So now I've got that marked on my mental calendar of like, okay, consider Kid Logic as a future episode topic. So this is a way for us to brainstorm future topics. And if you guys like it and you want to hear us riff on it some more, or if you just want to hear me try to paint myself into a corner by actually, borderline talking smack about a fellow cartoonist, which I'm not comfortable doing, leanintoart@gmail.com. And with that, I'm going to do this, because it's time for the topic. And we're going to start, as is our wont, to go 1,000 feet up and then whittle our way down to being back on the ground. And folks, if the jingles bother you, you can also let us know at leanintoart@gmail.com.
I feel like a kid again.
It almost felt kind of game show-like. I don't know about that. So, okay, self-learning skill set, research, Rob, research. And this topic occurred to me just the other night because I was thinking about how a couple episodes back when I was talking, we did the episode on the Samsung Galaxy Note.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of made a point out of remarking how much research I did on it. And I didn't feel like I did at the time, but then Anne and I were talking about the tablet. And I remember when, you know, she kind of talked me into getting it. She said, look, this is the first time I've seen you in years do that much research and that much legwork on a product. You never buy anything for yourself. She's like, I have to talk you into getting new shoes. You know, it's like, I'm not letting you walk away from this one. So apparently I did. And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized, yeah, I guess I was doing research. I was trying to answer very specific questions. And then the next question that I had for myself was, well, how did I do that? How did I think about it? And why do I get so impatient sometimes with people who ask really broad questions and you have to ask them follow-ups in order to whittle down to what they're really after, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think the first big idea we can hit at here is research is another way of saying trying to solve a problem, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's typically not pure research. It's applied research. Pure research is like, what happens when I wear, winter gloves and then I try to draw? What happens when I stand in my chair and I draw my Cintiq? What happens when, and you just experiment with less intent, which you can come up with some pretty wonderful things, I'd imagine, at some point. But typically applied research implies you have a target. There's something that you're hunting toward and getting, you want to get closer to, and you're trying to understand where you're currently at and how to get across that chasm. And one thing to mention, I also identified on a, it was emotions that were about 8 years old when I was researching for my Fujitsu tablet. And it was similar. There was like this cloud of for some topics, they will be less represented in your common, sources of information, where people just don't discuss a certain perspective that you need to mine for particular information. Then it's so hard to get that information because no one's sharing it.
Right.
And it's like this really difficult barrier to cross that makes the research. It's like you picked a certain research topic that just had a huge challenge level to it beyond your normal goal.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is the frustration that I was expressing in that episode about the Galaxy Note when I was talking about how every source of information I went to was being dismissive about this device because it had a pen, when that was the thing that I was excited about and wanted to know more information about. But the news sources or punditry that I was referring to wasn't going into any depth about it because they were outright dismissive, because they were not, they weren't a cartoonist, or artist or visual communicator of any kind. They were a tech journalist. And B, I'm not their audience. They have no obligation to service me on this, right? That made my work, that stacked up a whole lot of work in front of me to figure out, okay, well, if you want to know if this thing really does have a Wacom digitizer, whether it does have 1,024 levels of pressure sensitivity, if you want to know if the ink lines actually work as good as on a Wacom desktop tablet, you got to figure that out, kiddo. You got to start digging hard to figure that information out. And this is where I get to the first point that I jotted down in my notes. It's a big joke these days. Just Google it. Google it, dude. Right?
Yeah.
Google's the world brain, so why do we have to have any research skills after all?
Sure. It's not like you really need to sift through anything other than 2 decades of both useful and useless information or of a variety of, depending on your perspective, piles and piles of information. And just find that needle in a whole galaxy of haystack.
Yeah. It's like, I did an Ignite talk a couple years ago? I don't even remember. It was a while ago. I was a younger man and I was talking about how, I think it was the 21st Century Cartoonist talk, which I'll write down. I can put it in the show notes. There's a video of that.
I think it was last year at...
I don't even remember. It was in the last 24 months.
Yep.
But I make a point in that talk about how, if Google's the world brain...
Right. Ignite. Ann Arbor.
Yeah, it was Ignite Chelsea.
Chelsea, okay.
You can't just walk up to the world brain and say, how do I become a cartoonist? You have to have a very precise and specific question. Now, I happen to be lucky enough to be married to a librarian. And so I asked her, okay, well, how do you think about this? Like, what kind of bad research strategies have you borne witness to, and how do you solve that problem for people? Because you know, when you work in a library, you get asked a lot of weird questions. And she's like, well, kid walks in, says, I need a book about World War II. Mm. And, okay, there's a lot of books on World War II here. There's some fictional, historical fiction over here. Here's some books on, you know, tank design in World War II. Here's a in this section over here is a bunch of books on the types of uniforms worn in World War II. Here is a section over in this section over here is are some books on combat techniques used during World War II. Here's a book of maps that were used during World War II. What are you looking for? So she said, you know, like the first question she asks is, what do you need the book for? Are you writing a report? Are you reading for enjoyment? Is this part of a larger research strategy that you're trying to accomplish? You know, you're looking for World War II in regards to a study on the last X amount of major wars in the United States or world. Are you talking about them on a world stage? You know, what do you plan to do with this information? Then we can start to whittle down from there, right? And then it turns into, right, the specific information. After you've established the use case, establish the specific information that can assist you on the specific point problem you're trying to solve in completing the use case, right? Mm-hmm. And when she told me that, I was like, yeah, that's totally what I did when I was doing research. And when I do any kind of research on any of the books that I do, I don't just go to Pinterest and say, you know, oh, well, let's look up 1920s buildings. You know, it's like, well, I need to look up something really specific. I want flower shop storefronts of 1930s Brooklyn, you know. Is that how you think about it, Rob? I don't know if you have anything that you can throw on top of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, responding to a need is really important. Being able to identify the need and ideally additional qualities on top of it to give it a flavor. Like, I want to understand World War II enough to summarize key points based on the political events, or I wanted to talk about how much it was, how much it cost the world from a monetary sense, or I want to, you know, so you have to get that other, and I'm planning to talk about it in a positive light. And so I have this bias that I want to get in my research. So if you have an agenda on top of a perspective, on top of a need, then you can start to really get some filtering going.
Right.
Where ideally, if you're doing more of a data-driven approach, you want to gather targeted enough information, and then you're then react to it and discover, like, oh, here's the angle I'm curious about. It's not just the cost. There was a particular country that spent the most but had the smallest population, and now I can do some interesting visualization of that if it's like a if it's a data visualization project because okay. I have some interesting contrast in the data, but I didn't know that when I started, but I knew, you know, more of the I had to discover something partway through, like an initial research phase to get to the next phase.
Mm-hmm.
Where so the research may not be of a nature of just a just one cycle. It may be iterative.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, for sure. Especially like when I was first teaching myself HTML, you call it that when you're, you know, referring to books and resources online? I mean, I guess. But
yeah,
somebody...
I mean, that means you wrote the books, right? I mean, if you're learning on your own, I'm totally kidding. I've overthought this topic a lot lately. I think it's convenient enough that I think it has to do when we summarize, like when we're being self-taught and we're engaging in I think it means more self-directed learning, not
there we go.
Not consuming learning through a separate authority mechanism.
Right. But I think about like how, you know, when I started, I went to my local library, like, you know, most people of our generation would think, and where's the information? It's at the library. And I got a couple books on the subject, tried to get through them, and I was like, oh, this is impenetrable. There's so much front-ending of philosophy of HTML in some of these books when I just want to know, just walk me through some tutorials so I can get started so I can determine whether or not I can progress to level 2. Give me the training level, like in a video game, and that I can progress to level 2 and start taking it more seriously. But first, I want to play. And then I discovered webmonkey.com. Remember them? Are they still around?
They're still around. I was shocked. I came across them when I was doing research for my web design class I'll be doing at MCAD, because I was trying to look at it's MCAD for the FAIR program, the Fine Arts Interdisciplinary Resources Program, which FAIR is a high school in Minneapolis, and
they're still using that green monkey.
Yeah, I mean, I think they refined their logo a bit. I mean, I think. Yeah. He had more sharp angles, I think he was a more dangerous monkey in his youth, and he's mellowed out a little bit.
He's in his 20s now. He's mellowing out. But yeah, it was back in like 2001, I think. Yeah. this is where I get to be show my age. I printed out the tutorials. Printed them out, and I took them home. I was at work. I printed them out in the laser jet printer, and then I would take them home and I'd read them and practice them on the computer. So then I discovered WebMonkey, and that became like my go-to thing for like, okay, I'm going to learn how to make text red today. You know, I'm learning about hexadecimal colors in HTML.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, then I could start to read the book. So it was iterative in the sense that first I went to some easy, done-in-one tutorials. Then from there, I progressed to the full-on, more in-depth stuff in the actual how-to books, which led me to the third iteration of downloading people's source code and then gunking with that, right? So getting view source on a web page, downloading the HTML file, and playing with that until I understood, oh, that's what a BR tag does. And getting hands-on experience with that. So yeah, it can be totally iterative based on your self-directed learning style too, right? It doesn't have to be like... I instantly knew exactly what question to ask. All I did was search for HTML tutorials on Lycos or whatever the search engine was in 2001.
Gopher. maybe not that early. Which I suppose, I don't know if that's just, it may seem obvious that, well, when you begin your research, you may not know the questions that are actually going to help you land on the thing that'll make you feel like you have completed your research. But to me, I think that's pretty normal. I can't count how many projects I began that assumed a certain answer that answer got informed by further investigation.
Right.
And it changed.
And this is where I want to kind of... It sounds like we're edging towards another point that I had sort of locked and loaded for later on. Is that serendipity is okay?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not. You know, it's like I don't sit down to do a project. So for instance, another reason this topic of research came up in my mind is, so I hold in my hand the proof of Captain Cat number one. This is the one hot off the presses. My editing proof, which I don't know if you can see. There's little red marks in there. Yeah, you can't see them. But there's little red marks in, you know, all the errors I got to fix. But in writing this book, Anne and I sat down and said, well, we want this cat to talk in proper sailor language. And so we got a book called Sea Language Comes Ashore, which is a collection of colloquialisms from sailors. So like, for instance, a dry skin, a whale with scarcely any blubber. Hence in whaling communities, a man who leaves less property than was expected. Or Dutchman's anchor, something important that has been forgotten or left behind from the old jest about a Dutch shipmaster. Ooh, there's some racist stuff in this book. When was this from? Oh, 1945. but I mean, it's authentic sailor language. It's collected by this sailor enthusiast. Well, they don't like to be called sailors. Seamen, I found out. But I'm finding out things like one of the ones I really enjoyed writing. There will be blood in the scuppers today is one of the things Captain Cat says in the story, which is a seaman's expression for there's going to be trouble. Scuppers are the little holes in the side of the ship where water overflow comes out. So if there's like a lot of bad things happening on the deck, there's going to be blood coming out of the scuppers. It's an exaggerated hyperbolic expression. It's a bit of an idiomatic expression, but it makes my characters more authentic. So where was I going with all this, with this talking about?
Well, you were mentioning the serendipity. So yes. Did that book just kind of fall in on your head when you were in the library, or what do you?
No. It was a book that we checked out of the library a long time ago, just out of pure curiosity. Like, sea language comes ashore. Wait a minute, this is a collection of colloquial expressions from sailors. That's kind of, I had no plan to do anything with that in the form of a book. But then when Anne and I started talking about this book, she was like, oh man, remember that book? I was like, yeah, we should use it. I didn't start the research with the sense of, I'm going to do a story about a sailor cat in approximately 1920. And he should speak in pidgin English or something like that, right? It was more of, you know, we remembered a book, we looked at it and said, yeah, this could be useful. When Anne brought up the whole Galaxy Note research and said, well, how did you research that? Said, were you trying to find a tablet with pressure sensitivity? I said, well, indeed, no. I was just reading tech news, and I happened to be breezing across an article about some new Samsung tablet, and I saw a line at the bottom of the article that said, oh, and the Wacom pressure-sensitive surface and stylus doesn't hurt. And it was the final line of the article. And I went, what? And then I quickly started reading whatever I could on the subject. So like, is that for true? Or did somebody just say that as an offhanded remark and they didn't verify it, you know? So that thing serendipitously flew across my view because I happened to be tuned into a certain channel, which led to deeper research, which led to me spending $500 on a tablet that I didn't have.
Go ahead. you were equipped with some kind of let's see. I mean, I think as you work on your creative projects and whatever that is. So for me, I do this all the time with my day job. So I do user experience design, user experience architecture, and a lot of that is research driven, and it'll be based on you know, topics and industries that I'm not an expert in, at least initially I'd be, you know, a novice or less to begin with, but then I climb up. I'm used to practicing this finding out what's meaningful within a given, you know, within a business, and who are they competing with, and what are they trying to do, and what are others trying to do like that. And I go through this process that helps get me generally informed. And also, I think there's just biases and triggers and filters that everybody, when you make things and you keep making things and, you build your skills, like you get these heuristics basically where you get a sense for what's important. And basically, I guess that's what it is. You get a sense for that important feeling. And it, once it's triggered, then okay, you've something came across your radar, and then that is, it's worth filing. It's worth, you know, so that's where, I don't know if I'm jumping. This is like a really interesting segue possibly into the next segment.
Oh wow! Okay, right on mark. So should I play the segue music? I mean,
yes.
And I'll eventually stop saying that before I play the segue music. I'll just listen to your cue, and I'll naturally respond to it.
Ham fisted. Let's go.
Could this get any clumsier?
I'm about.
And it deserves Zentradi music because. Yes. And I'm gonna add more music to the sound bank. So. You know what? On the ground. Let's get some boots on the ground and figure out, okay, all this philosophizing about doing research is all well and good. You sold me on the concept of why I have to think harder about my research and solving my problems. What do I use to do this? Now, Rob, I know that you are a fan of the mind maps.
I'm a mind mapper, yes.
What does that mean?
Let's see.
Left hemisphere, right hemisphere, this side's creative, this side's logical.
Mm. You know what? We're doing a video podcast. Why don't I share an app real quick?
Oh, cool. This is Borderline Stupid.
Let's see if I can do this on the fly. Borderline Stupid?
Borderline Stupid helping tip.
Yeah.
But this is actually just plain tip. So mind mapping tools. Yeah, it would be a good idea to actually show it on screen.
I'll describe it too, of course, for listeners. Let's see. Here we go. Are you able to see this window? Looks probably like it. All right.
I'm not seeing it yet.
You're not? Okay.
Not yet, but it might be an issue with my bandwidth.
I will screen share again. So what I'm screen sharing is an application on Mac OS X.
I see it now.
Called MindNode Pro, which there's a free version called MindNode, and there's a lot of other options out there, such as FreeMind. FreeMind.sourceforge.net is a free and open source one as well, cross platform. Then the awesome iPad app is, which is incredible, is iThoughts HD. And anyway, enough of that. So there's plenty of tools out there. So what you get in a mind map is it's about conceptual groupings of things. It just lit, and so in a way you could do this as an outline, right? So some people, outlining feels natural. This is not much different. It's just it takes a different visual shape than your typical tree. So let's what are we trying to mind map right now?
How about research?
Okay, research. Okay. How meta. Let's see. So we have the theory, and we have practice, and we under other practice we have examples. And I'm just writing it this way because it just came to mind.
Right.
And then if I'm like, oh, that doesn't look, I can drag stuff around. And so theory, we have the reasoning behind research, and maybe some benefits. Tips, stupid helpy tips. So you see that basically I'm coming up with phrases, and then inherently they're connected to a parent idea. And it's very outline-ish, right? And then,
but it's not the kind of like forced structure outline of a bullet-pointed list like you see, like you did when you were a kid in school, right? It's more of like a family tree kind of thing, or like the tree of life kind of idea, right? It just branches out, and you start with a big idea, and you whittle your way down to progressively smaller, more narrow ideas. But this is just brainstorming, right?
Yeah. Well, it's brainstorming with a little bit of structure implied, because you can there's low friction. You're not having to, well, depending on how you look at this, if you feel comfortable with this structure, it's a pretty easy way to capture a bunch of thoughts. Because you can start out like this. So we can, some of this was coming out structured, but then let's say we have another angle on it. The case against, right? And then I start continuing down this path. It's, not that. Homonym. All right. I wrote waste of time as a literally like your waist above your hips, as opposed to a waist basket. Anyway, so other topics may come to mind, and you capture them any way you want. And then you, because they're in this app, you can say, "Well, here you go. I just dragged this whole node under another node." I could promote them. I can, group and do all sorts of things. I could grab just the items underneath that other item and then move stuff around. So, and then it's a pretty flexible mechanism to capture things in a semi-structured fashion. And if you want, it could be really, really heavily structured. And then you can do different things with it. So like if you captured a mind map, and like I mentioned, mind map's an outline, you can export it to OPML, which OPML happens to be a very open outlining format that a lot of applications will read in. And so maybe this is a start of a document to go deeper, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of that app that I have that you've sent me some OPML files through. I should just try to open it real quick because it'll open automatically
Scribe.
In that app.
Scribe.
Oh, is it Scribe? Because yeah, it opens it in an outline format. Mm-hmm. So in one app, like in MindNote, it looks like what we're seeing on the screen right now, this kind of like tree of ideas. But then once you open it up in Scribe, suddenly, boom, it looks like a traditional outline. It's cool that it can be so easily restructured both ways. I mean, it makes sense once you actually look at it a little bit.
Exactly. And it's just whatever form fits your style better. And one thing when you're doing, when you're researching, is you may not have a clear, strong building block to be the final deliverable for your research, right? And you may be discovering that as you're grouping and putting these ideas together and then reorganizing them. And what you're doing here is you're modeling, right? And modeling means you're establishing your, it's a, let's see, modeling is a lot like a metaphor for ideas, which if I offended someone with how annoyingly meta that was, sorry. Models are very helpful to summarize and get a lot of benefit out of less expression. So if you're figuring out a data visualization, you land upon your model, now you know more of how you can tell the story with this data, because you decided, oh, this is a lot like a this research topic, and if we're gathering data on research to report, here's what's effective, or here's where most people claim different tools help them or whatnot, and we're trying to summarize it like that, we could say, you could use the classic bookcase metaphor, right? Where is knowledge? You put it in a book, you put it in a bookcase, and then, you know, if you have sort of topics that are somehow resonating, and you could create a visual metaphor with it, and you can build that off of a model, possibly. Otherwise, anyway, I think I'm jumping straight back into the theory as I'm starting to describe this.
Well, you have to explain theory in order to understand the use cases for these tools. I mean, this is no different than just using a dry erase board, but not everybody has dry erase boards in their house, right? Mm-hmm. And as a guy who collects notes in notebooks and sketchbooks, sometimes stuff gets lost because I don't have a clear track of what my thinking process was. I've talked in the past about how when I'm writing my stories sometimes, when I'm really stuck, I'll sit down and have a conversation with myself in text form where I just write, what does this mean? What is this character's motivation? Why does this character want to do this? What's the thing stopping them? And then I just start wondering aloud in text, like actually writing down on the notebook.
That's a great case where your character motivations was one, a mind map that I've played around with before. So storytelling, characters, and name a character and then their inner motivation, or yeah, how were you classifying that? I was moving too slow to capture it.
Oh, well, no, but see, that's just it, is that when I was having these conversations, it would be literally in conversational form, so it wouldn't have this kind of structure to it. I would have to go back and read and reread to infer the structure out of that, right?
Sure.
So with something like this, it could be a way to have that conversation in a nice visual way where I'm saying character, then I would put character motivation, character fear, character wish, right?
Yep.
Like, what are they afraid of? What do they hope for? Aspiration and terror, right? Which we've talked about before. And then, I would go through and I have done this with virtually every book I've ever done, is how does each character feel about each other character?
Mm-hmm. And so that's where the structure of this would break down, because for the most part, mind maps are great as being trees. They're not great as being, when diagrams, another term for them is graphs, right? So mm-hmm. I think mind maps are like a hierarchical graph, and then what you're describing is a network graph. So any node can connect to any other node. And so that's just a case where maybe even just doing, if we're talking about tools, I mean, there's things like OmniGraphle that there are less expensive tools. I mean, it's definitely a very refined, great tool for the job. But if I weren't in the profession that I'm in, I don't know if I would use it as much, because it's pretty expensive for what it does.
Isn't there Omni makes a product for the iPad too? Is it Omni Outliner? Is that what it's called? Or is it just OmniGraphle for the iPad? It's like
they make their versions of their products for both platforms. And I've got them all basically. The let's see, I'm going to switch which screen I'm sharing.
Okay. OmniGraphle for Mac. But yeah, I played with the iPad version, which I found to be actually pretty darned awesome for either doing wireframes. I think that we got it so that Anne could do wireframes for a project.
Yep.
Are you looking at that right now? Is this OmniGraphle?
Yes. So, looking at just grabbing some shapes so I can just throw some shapes down, different kinds of shapes. And of course, I mean, you can do this in like a presentation tool is another really good stand-in for often way less money. So like a Keynote or a PowerPoint can do this kind of thing pretty well. Visio is another famous one. So let's say you see character relationships.
V-I-Z-I-O.
What's that?
V-I-Z-I-O, Visio.
V-I-S-I-O. Visio.
V-I-S-I-O.
Microsoft product.
I'm pulling up stuff on TVs. Okay, here we go. Microsoft Visio 2010. I'm just grabbing links.
All right. I suppose I should use a better example. Now I'm switching to Robotech as my... Yeah. And anyway, so now if I wanted to start doing some connections between these characters and have different kinds of connections and all that.
Mm-hmm. And you could even do like a color-coded kind of thing where like animosity would be one color, or friendship would be another color, ambivalence could be another color if you really wanted to do like a whole legend, right?
Yep. And so you can do all sorts of interesting things as far as the arrows, then you can start labeling them and whatnot. And anyway, so this would be a way to, what are you doing here? You're capturing research. You're because there's that iterative cycle where how do you know what you're learning if you aren't putting it in some kind of concrete form as you're going along with your research, so you can make further insightful observations on it. And so you realize that you realize new things, and then it gives you a chance to explain them.
Yeah, I think that you just threw out, I mean, I just grabbed all these links that you just mentioned for the show notes. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different things for people to try out, right now if they want to. So That's a lot of good food for thought on tools. I want to ask you, Rob, do you do the Boolean searches?
the Booleans? Yeah, I hang with the Booleans. Yep.
I wouldn't let my daughter marry one of them, but they're nice people.
I love the Booleans. I don't. It's what's funny is, so you get into the topic of like language parsing and whatnot, and so search engines have made it less important overall for us to need to worry about Booleans. But back when search engines were more raw with their, that's what you're talking about, right? As far as doing, you know, Google-based research and whatnot.
Yeah, Google-based or any search engine-based research, where you'll say, it's like one of the things that I was running into when I was researching the Galaxy Note was, it would pull up the Galaxy tab, information about the Galaxy tab, and so then right. when I updated my search to be, in quotation marks, Galaxy Note 10.1 minus tab, right?
Right.
Refined my search. Another thing that I think people should know, I mean, this is like a 101 thing, but you know, Google, if you use Google a lot, they changed the way search works. And so like people will say to me like, hey, Jersey, you were number one on my search about comics, you know? And I'm like, that's because you had social search on and we're friends on some different social networks, right? Yeah. And so that you've got like the world search, like the, what do they call it? I better go to Google right now. Just do a search on it. Oh, rats.
Well, there is also the advanced search as well.
Yeah.
And if you want to have less of your, you want to break out of your, it's an information bubble, right? I mean, I remember way back in the 90s, all this excitement about mass customization that you can do via web technology. And what the thing is as these services watch your behavior, you're getting more and more tuned into an info stream that's tuned into what you're interested in, but that actually chokes out serendipity more and more. Mm-hmm. And it also chokes out other perspectives, like flat out conflicting ideas that maybe are interesting to think about once in a while, right? Like think about our curveball.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say, like, or we could provide some delightful cognitive dissonance that will make you think harder about the things that you want to write about. You know?
And everyone wants that, right?
but you know, so I think that's something where I think at least some of the people that I know, they weren't aware that there's now a toggle switch in Google searches where if you hover over it, it says show personal results. If you hover over the globe, it says hide personal results. So yeah, you get two different search streams every time you perform a search. Boolean searches also, I mean, YouTube as a resource for research, especially if you use really good search terms and not just say tablet Wacom, right? Because you just know I'm asking about an Android tablet from Samsung.
Right.
That I can draw on with Wacom pressure sensitivity. No, you've got to be really precise with that question, right?
Yeah. I mean, Google's trying to read your mind, but they're not quite there yet.
It's like Jim Gaffigan made a joke about, you know, like those menus in fast food restaurants where they just have it numbered. Like, you know, just two. Just give me two. And he predicted that in the future it's going to be just like a grunt. We're just going to go like, eh, eh. You know, it's like – that's what I think some people want to use the internet for.
There, it may be a whole ecosystem of grunts, bleeps, and bloops because fast food, back in the day when I worked there, they already had all the beeps and the different kinds of beeps for all the different things. And I, you know, if I'm around too many beeps, I freak out to this day. There's maybe not, but no, actually, no, that happens. And so it could be just maybe you have to match the beep of the fries. And it'll just, it's like a language, right? You got to go boop, 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 boop. And then they'll, like, run to the fry station. I don't know.
To this day, the sound of a casino still fills me with sadness and dread. To this day. I mean, it's been over a decade since I worked at a casino. But, like, if they're doing, like, if a TV show comes on and I hear, like, those slot machine noises that bloop, 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 and then hear the coins clinking, yeah. It's the fastest way to depress me.
Wow. And yeah, and that's totally against the reinforcement that those sounds are designed to bring about.
Work at one for 4 years and watch people throw away a lot of money.
I know. Exactly. Yeah. Well,
especially if you are in a especially fragile soul like I am about some things where like, you know, I've been known to bawl a little bit when I'm watching the animatronic Abraham Lincoln talk at Disneyland. So, anyway, okay, so does that conclude our...
Well, Thing as far as the searching and whatnot and the and the tools. So obviously you may not be ready to do that analytical mapping yet before, you know, while you're in more gathering your research. So if we, like if we had to break it down to phases, let's take a quick swing at that. And also just wanted to mention Evernote and tools like I mean, they're really handy. So you could use stuff like Twitter, Pinterest, Instapaper, Evernote, and they're like collection points. And you know, if you're doing
this was two episodes ago, man. We talked about if this then that, right? Which you can use to automate your information gathering. Evernote, Pinterest I use as well for grabbing photos for I'll make what do you call them, galleries for different projects. So here's some photo research I'm doing for gathering reference material for an upcoming project.
Cool. You know? It's like the modern morgue file, right?
Yeah. Your photo morgue, which I still have my old one, which was a physical binder. And then my more recent ones were folders on my desk or on my hard drive, and I would actually group the folders in each project file. So here's Equalizers of the Divide. Here's the reference folder for Equalizers of the Divide, right? And then you could subcategorize it into locations, color theory, costuming, whatever you want to subcategorize it by, right? But now with Pinterest, you can just do that in the cloud.
Yeah, and it's. It does help, reduces a lot of the friction and just physical difficulties in gathering a bunch of information. And one thing I do use, actually, combining your Google search tip with Evernote, is there is a, I believe it's in the Evernote Web Clipper plugin that basically you can say, yep, for Chrome, and it's available for Firefox as well. Basically you can, that's a really handy thing to use to do the information gathering, but it has another setting where as you're doing a Google search, you can search your Evernote as well. Right. So simultaneously you're getting a couple of searches accomplished, you know, in one search attempt, basically. Pretty handy.
Also using in terms of using Twitter, another thing you can do is if you use Pinboard, which I really like, which was sort of like the successor to Delicious. Pinboard costs money. It's a one-time fee to pay, but it's a really nice service in my opinion. And you can set it up so that anytime, and you could set up an if this then that rule for this if you wanted to, but every time I favorite a tweet, it gets archived in my Pinboard, right? You know, I've got a record of, so like if somebody says something like, oh, here's a link to a really interesting thing that Jersey, you don't have time to read right now, favorite, now it's on my pin board, right? Mm. So simple little things like that can be really great ways to gather information. Also just the simple, I mean, if you've got a digital device like a phone or a tablet of some sort, or even a laptop, just email it to your Evernote and then you create a special notebook. I've got one called Links. And so then when I find a really interesting link, if I don't have the Evernote web clipper on me, I've just got my iPhone or something, I'll email it to myself, and then the subject line put the @ links. It goes into that notebook, so I can easily refer to it later on. So, yeah.
So that's I think that is an awesome set of capabilities. I mean, it's amazing the kind of tools you have for research nowadays, right? So, but I still think you're stuck doing the heavy lifting on in the beginning and toward the end when you're starting to connect all the when you're thinking of the questions to begin with and setting forth on that researching, and then lots of helpful things in the middle, but you still have to pick where you're going to do your hunting. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just worth a note on its own, or I don't know how we're doing for time. Probably.
Oh no, we're coming up. We're coming up on the to the takeaways in a second here. Yeah. I've got a pre takeaway. Speaking of Evernote, the thing about Evernote is, it's only as good as the notes you keep in it. So, I was at a Kids Read Comics meeting about a month ago, and in that meeting, we were discussing what the prospective dates for next year were. Like we had like some candidate dates, and we had like an option A, 90% sure that we could do this. Option B, 70% sure. Option C. Don't want to do it, but we will if we have to, kind of thing. Wrote them down on note cards first. But then at the end of the meeting, I took pictures of them with my phone so they'd be dropped into my Evernote, which has some OCR capabilities, optical character recognition, so I can search my notes better. But I have a Kids Read Comics notebook in my Evernote where I keep all that stuff, so it's easy to go back and refer to. Today, I'm on my way with one of the partners of Kids Read Comics. I'm on my way to a meeting with one of the partners for next year's show, and on the docket is discussing next year's dates with them. So I'm like, no problem. I've got it in my Evernote. Thank goodness. Just before I walked out the door, I made sure to look in my Evernote to see, oh, yeah, where was that note again? I should just have it at the ready so I can just pull it up real quick. Open up the note. The picture, here's the date. Let's say the date's right here where I wrote it. You can't read. This isn't the same card. Yeah. But here's what the picture took. It took this, like this, right? Oops. So like I had the bottom half of the card, but the part with the date was not captured when I took the photo for some reason, and I thought I got it. So then I'm like, oh crap, I don't remember the date. I had to take, I trusted Evernote to just take a picture of it, and I didn't take a very good picture. So I had to run downstairs. Thank goodness I still had my messenger bag with the actual original cards. I thought I threw them away. I was ready to freak out. I had 5 minutes to get to my meeting, found the cards. Got to go to the meeting, you know, smooth as glass. But it was a reminder to me that, yeah, I take a picture of the stuff, but you better also, you know, type it into it too, just to be on the safe side, like at least like headliner information.
Yeah, I think tagging or a little bit of just a let whatever is coming to mind fly right out quick and continue on. But, because it is better to have that than nothing. Because, sure, Evernote has optical character recognition. It has handwriting recognition, which is that's how it gets the information off of whiteboards and, you know, note cards. But it doesn't – because I have so many notes in my Evernote, and it doesn't always recognize the handwriting perfectly, right? So I can get a lot of false positives. You can say on most any word I type in.
Yeah.
Because Evernote's like, I guess that's what this says on that note card from 2 years ago.
So it was the best of times. It was the blurst of times. yeah. That's a paraphrasing of a Simpsons joke. But anyway. But yeah. Yeah. Your Evernote's only as good as the notes that you take. So that's another thing that you were kind of hinting at earlier is that this does – we have so many more options, but it doesn't alleviate us of having to think carefully and be judicious in our decisions and identify what the problems are that we're trying to solve and use the tools that we have wisely to solve those problems.
If I can add to the summary, it's the I often use the informal storytelling style of research to become informed enough on a topic and not like the heavily scientific, researched with data, because I'm on a lot of projects, and I would bet whether they're personal or not, I mean it's true for me. I will research to a level of satisfaction that I feel like I can speak intelligently and back up perspectives. But like I have this goal where I know my finish line is probably, I would love to have more time to go even further, right? To then, maybe I pass enough scrutiny in my own tests and my own heuristics for, you know, being able to make use of this research. But then, there comes a point where doing much more, it would get more expensive and more time than either I have or that there's budgeted on a given project. And
I think is it safe to say, Rob, that you kind of at least a little bit subscribe to the hacker ethos of get it done better, not best, right? And then iterate on it.
Exactly. And it's just that I wanted to mention that there's different. That idea is useful in the land of research, even though I think, I think it was a few episodes back when you pointed out the word, it was a vocab word that there was a population that was concerned about it getting abused, and it was,
curator.
Curator, yeah. And I just want to honor that. Yeah, research has some pretty heavy hitters behind it. as far as how they feel that word is properly used. And I acknowledge that, but I think many other flavors of research exist alongside of it that serve different needs. Like for telling your story, you don't have to actually be able to have, like, learn brain surgery to have a brain surgeon in your story. You don't have to, right?
Right, right. No, and that stopped me before, is I've avoided writing about police characters in certain stories I've done because I feel like I don't know the legal system and the life of a police officer and the life of law enforcement enough to be able to do this with any kind of justice. But back to your earlier point, is I'm gonna make a lot of people mad. So I'm going to do some research on this curated collection of sailor language, and then I'm going to architect a comic out of that. How's that? Okay, internet, come get me.
Come on.
But those are the three big ones. Those are the three ones that, like the word snobs. I shouldn't characterize them as word snobs, but people who get uptight about word meaning, and I totally sympathize and identify with that. Those are three ones that tend to spark a lot of ire.
Exactly. And I do think it's useful in this to give a little extra context for how we're tackling research.
To be a responsible source of information, you know? And that was one of the points that we skipped over earlier, was that you have to consider the source. Consider the source and what their intent and who their audience is before you act on any information they give you. So when you're listening to a tech podcast and somebody says, what about the Galaxy Note 10.1? Oh, that dumb thing with a pen? Who said that? Now, I'm not saying the Galaxy Note is the best tablet that was ever made. Is it as well constructed as an iPad? Heck no. But because this person looked at it, held it up to an iPad, said, it's not an iPad, pen, whatever, I have to then ask the question, well, is this guy an artist? Is he even considering what the pen capabilities can do? Because that's what I'm interested in. And I'm going to base my total evaluation of the device on starting with this. This is the pen technology is the uppermost piece of the hierarchical list of considerations. Build quality's in there, but it gets outflanked by capability to create, right?
Absolutely.
So, consider the source. And not all sources are as responsible as Rob Stenzinger and actually provide you with some context of where they're coming from, sadly. So, not that you provide that context, sadly.
It's typically sadness. From a place of sadness. Like, I've done the universe wrong and I'm trying to make up for it.
So, you ready to move on to takeaways? Yes. I got a takeaway that we've been waiting 3 weeks for me to do, and I feel like I'm just going to let everybody down because all that anticipation, it's not that great. It's more like, so that concludes our talk on research. We'll do more on research down the road, I'm sure, because all these topics are worth revisiting. So takeaway time, I don't have a jingle for that one. Rob, you like the music. You should be giving me some music to use for some of these stingers and jingles.
You got it. I know this really cool song by Five Finger Death Punch. What?
Five Finger Death Punch. Mm-hmm. And, it's like, I want, their top five, like, why me? Why does this keep happening to me? Life's not fair.
You did this to me. And that made me do this.
Trying is hard, so I'm not going to do it anymore. You can't fight City Hall. Anyway. We're giving them a plug, actually. So my takeaway this week from the past couple weeks is I'm working on a book with Dan Mishkin. And when I say working on a book, what I mean is we are in the process of completing a pitch to give to our agent so that the agent can shop it around. Once the agent sells it to somebody, then I will be fully in earnest working on the book. But, I'm working on a handful of pages for the pitch. And it's been a while since I worked with a writer, like somebody who just writes. I don't mean that in a diminutive sense. I mean that they specifically write, and that is their main skill set, mm-hmm. Which gives them a completely different perspective than me as a visual storyteller, right? Even though he and I can spend literally hours on the phone talking about characters and character motivation and what implications it has to an overall plot thread and, what kind of surprise you can have in a plot. Even though we can talk about all that stuff with the same verbal language, when it comes to what happens on the page, we have completely different contexts and viewpoints and approaches to doing it. And we came up with a flow that sounded like it was going to work. And we did it. But I was so caught off guard because as a guy who's been writing his own stuff for a long time, and as a guy who thinks really hard about his stuff, you know, I've talked in the past about the three layers or four layers of visual rhythm where you've got the panel shapes and groupings. Then you have the contents of the panel, the drawings inside the panel, and their groupings is the second layer. And then the third layer is the sound elements. Mm-hmm. And just like a band where you can have a backbeat and a rhythm section and then the lead section, all these different things can either work together or they can work in a pleasant cacophony or they can work in a bad cacophony, you know? And it's really, you know, it's, I think really hard about those, balancing those elements together when I'm designing my pages. So when I did the thumbnails of this book, I gave them to Dan and I sent him the quick sketches. And he said, oh, this is great. I like this, I like that, maybe change this. And he said, I'll go ahead and do the balloon spotting and send them back to you. Balloon spotting meaning he was going to figure out where the sound elements were going to go. And I forgot that in the time he worked for DC Comics, that's what the writer did. The writer had to do balloon spotting. And it explains why some DC Comics that I grew up on had a really, really bad word balloon placement, because I bet not everybody was as visually fluent as Dan Mishkin was. And then going back, I went back and looked at some of his old comics from the 80s, and I was really caught off guard by it. But wow, this balloon placement is really excellent. And he openly credits Len Wein as being the guy who taught him how to do it so well. But he sends me back these pages, and not only are the balloon spots really great, but he's putting balloons in places where I would never put them. Why? Because he's covering up art. He's covering up visual elements that maybe aren't crucial to the story, but it's a visual element. You put those balloons in negative space. You don't put them in the positive space, right? But Dan wasn't thinking that way. Dan was thinking, what is the natural visual? He wasn't considering the art as being the primary storytelling vehicle. He was considering it a component of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking for the man now. He may disagree with me. But what I interpreted is he was interpreting – or he was working on it with – working on this thing, placing the balloons with the art as a consideration, not the consideration. Whereas I have trouble separating writing from art because they're so infused when I work. He was coming at it from a writer's perspective who has a very fluent visual literacy, but it's okay to cover up put balloons in, like, in the middle of a character's chest. And when I looked at it, I was like, why is he putting it in the middle of a character's chest? And then I backed away and went, that's the perfect place to put the balloon. And I never would have thought of it because I don't back away enough from my pages and my work to look at it with a writer's eye the way he does. So big idea, big takeaway is that collaboration can sometimes net you some really interesting discoveries about yourself as an artist and about new ways to approach the work. And it especially helps if you're working with a world-class writer, you know, if you're, or a world-class collaborator. Mm-hmm. But in any case, if I went back 12 years and said, what would I have said in this situation? I have to admit, I think I probably would have said, he's a writer. He doesn't know what he's doing. I'm the visual guy. I decide where these word balloons go. The heck with him. I would have missed out on that opportunity to really figure out something unique about my work. So when I'm lettering Captain Cat, I'm thinking about that as I'm putting the page together. And I had to fight my natural inclination to move the balloons in a negative space and let them rest in some positive space, because thinking about it that way, it actually made a better flow on the page. So I hope that was worth it. Hope it was worth the wait. That was it. That was my takeaway.
I think that's really awesome. And the reading flow is a big deal. It's one of those it's totally a user-centric angle to look at comics, because it's one of the ways you're conveying information, and it's worth prioritizing the experience of consuming that information. And is it some conflict or difficulty into the flow of consuming that comic by not seeing the importance of that? I mean, it's that's really cool. And to get that perspective from a collaborator, that's pretty sweet.
What I told him was, I was like, you didn't know it, but you gave me a, you know, postgraduate course on lettering with those balloon spots. It was an awakening. looking at those things, going, at first recoiling in horror and then realizing that the thing that horrified me was actually exactly what I needed to see at that moment.
Well, so I'm curious, like what you described at first was sort of like the Jersey Drozd taxonomy of comic communication, right?
Yeah.
Now, with this new perspective from Dan Mishkin, did that extend the taxonomy, or is that just sort of a...
No, I would say, if anything, I feel like it just refined it for me. It gave me a broader... I learned a dialect.
Okay.
Right?
Maybe loosen some of the relationships between the former strong hierarchy. Put some arrows to cross some boundaries.
Maybe. It almost feels like it kind of reinforced some divisions between the hierarchies too, because by looking at the balloon spotting as being something that can outright interfere with the art when it needs to, right? It can jump right in the way. And I've done it before, usually to hide bad art. Like, oh, I really screwed that up. I'll just put a word balloon there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We've all done it. Well, maybe a lot of us have done it, not all of us. But
I've totally done it.
But thinking about it as being something that can actually cover up something that it's like here I am in a box right now on your screen, right? And there's this big empty space here and this big empty space here. It's the difference between putting the word balloon here and putting the word balloon here, you know? And discovering that in some instances, putting it here actually makes the most sense, right? So it felt like, in a way, it hardened some of those divisions between the layer of how sound elements work in comics and the art. And it also was discovering a personal shortcoming in my work that I'm terrified of negative space, and I'm also terrified of covering up things that what I consider to be principal players of the scene, whether they're actors or elements, right? And that there are times when that can be done, and it actually works better. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. That's the gold that we're hunting for as we're doing these projects, right? Is those
those moments.
Yeah, those moments.
Those moments are so much better than even like holding the finished book in your hand in a way, you know? Because you know what those moments mean? Those moments mean the promise of an even better thing, right? Those moments mean like the next thing I do is going to be so much better than the last thing I did because now I know this.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when it's one of those concrete kind of like revelatory moments. But anyway, yeah, it was really cool. I was really, really – that was the moment where whether or not the book gets published, I'm grateful that I got to do that thought experiment with Dan. You know, and if the book does get published and I wind up having to commit for a year and a half to get this thing done, I know it's going to – I'm going to come out a completely changed person artistically, right? So.
Wow.
Anyway, did you have any takeaways this week that you want to throw on, or should we just get to our closing bits where we throw out some news about stuff that's going on?
No, I think that was good. Let's move on to closing it up.
So where are we going to be? If you guys are watching this at the time of the stream, this weekend I'm going to be at the Small Press Expo, spexpo.com, in Bethesda, Maryland, September 15th and 16th. If it's after September 15th, sorry, I missed you, if you couldn't make it. But, I'm going to be there for the weekend with Casey Van Heiss and of wintersandlavelle.com and my wife, Anne. And I'm going to be debuting my new book that Anne and I did together, Captain Cat, Former Shark Hunter, 8-page mini-comic, which I penciled, inked, and we're toning it together, too. So.
Wow. There's the spread, huge...
The two-page spread that I showed last time. But, yeah, we're also toning it. And I'm using techniques from that I picked up from Brandon Dayton of BrandonDayton.com in terms of, like, digital painting style. And I think it's looking really good. I'm kind of happy with it. Also has really good, I think, really good balloon spotting after my experience working with Dan. So that's where I want to give a this is something I think we should start doing too, Rob.
Yeah.
I didn't give you a chance. Are you to be making any public appearances anyplace soon besides, you know, going to Costco or to Safeway?
Well, let's see. Actually, there's a chance I'll be at FallCon, which is October 6th, and making some progress there. Discussions underway. So I'm really stoked about that. That's SpringCon and FallCon are they're big events in the Minneapolis area for the community.
It's like an outdoor arts festival, isn't it?
No, I believe it's indoor. I think it's at the state fairgrounds.
Okay.
Yep.
Maybe that's why I thought it was outdoor, because I knew it was in association with, or it was on the fairgrounds at least. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, I need to learn more about the event. I think that the FallCon is in the education building, and then the SpringCon, I think, is in the grandstand, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Sort of.
You'll link to it in the show notes, right?
Yep, definitely.
So October 6th, FallCon, you can go meet Rob if you're in the Minneapolis area. So, okay, so now we get to the part where I harangue the listeners for, you know, for support. You know, we save it for the end for those of you faithful who stuck all the way through and said, you know what, this Jersey guy, this Rob guy, they said some pretty interesting stuff, especially the Rob guy. So what can I do to give them, to pay it forward, to give it back to them? So I thought what we could do is, instead of like just saying like our sponsor of the show is leanintoart.com/workshops, we should do a pick of the week. Mm. And since my takeaway was the balloon spotting, learning through collaboration with Dan, I thought my pick of the week could be learning or lettering with Adobe Illustrator, which is a one-off workshop in the leanintoart.com/workshop section of the site. Hour-long video where, you know, I walk through my whole process of doing word balloons and some sound elements in Adobe Illustrator, and you can find out how I do all this kind of cool stuff on my pages. So that's at leanintoart.com/workshops. It'll be linked in the show notes too. That'd be a really great way to support us, is purchase a workshop. You know, we get something, you get something. But hey, my pockets are empty. I'm a poor artist after all. No problem. If there's another way that's absolutely free that you could help us out, if you want to thank us for all of the work that we do to put the show together, go to iTunes and give us a star review. It's anonymous. You don't have to actually write a review. You can just choose how many stars you think we deserve. That helps the show a lot. It helps make us more visible. If you think other people would benefit from the stuff that we talk about on the show, giving us a star review makes it more likely that when they're doing their research on the web that they're actually going to find us. Or you could give this video on YouTube a thumbs up. That would be another really great way to help make us more visible to more people.
Exactly. It gives it that serendipity magic. It helps us pop up on lists. So
callbacks are always good for concretizing learning information. So, okay, well, hey, Rob, thanks for walking around this one with me. I think that there's a lot of really cool stuff in there.
Well, cool. My pleasure, Jersey. And, yep, always happy to go deeper into this topic, too. So, by all means, when we're about to give our shout-out addresses or whatnot, ping us on Twitter. Yep. Let us know what you think.
Or just send us an email at leanintoart@gmail.com.
Awesome.
So, thank you again, Rob. Thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening. Thanks for the folks who showed up for the live stream and watched us on YouTube. We will be back. Rob, I don't know if I'm going to be back by next Tuesday. I'm going to have to look at my calendar.
Yeah.
We might have to, because I'm going to be at SPX.
Well, we may have to do an adjustment in the schedule.
I hate being that guy. Oh, I feel like a prima donna. I'm sorry, Rob.
That's it. It's all right. I want to give a shout out, too. A lot of times we do mention the names of folks that show up in our comments field, is like our chat room in the on YouTube, and Lar D'Souza showed up and gave us a comment, which is pretty fun. Well, I love Lar's work, and we'll have to link to him in the show notes.
You know what? I wasn't seeing the comments until just now. I refreshed the comments field on the YouTube video.
Pretty funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah.
We'll be back again. We may have to adjust our schedule a little bit, but it's typically Thursday evenings.
Tuesday.
Tuesday evenings.
Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah.
So until then, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of ComicsAreGreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I want to say thank you again, Jersey. And I have been Rob Stenzinger of Interactive-Storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leans aren't leans. Thanks for listening.